Hello and welcome to the Edufuturist podcast. It's great to have you with us. This just me and Steve today. Ben is having a well-deserved break with his family, but we've got another fantastic episode for you coming up. Before we get into it, Steve, it's I think we were together for BET for the BET conference. If our listeners don't know what BET is the kind of the big expo for ed tech in the UK in London at the Excel. So we were there. When was it now? God, it feels like so long ago. A couple of weeks ago.
Last week of March. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. So I've just been away for a bit of a break myself. So just trying to catch up. Have you had a break yourself, Steve?
Never, absolutely never. So I had a long weekend, but no, I do get some solace at the minute for my craziness. I am within a month of marathon distance and marathon race, so I am currently doing about three. Getting out once or twice a week and doing post or plus 3 hours. So I'm about 18 mile mark in terms of I'll do that for a couple of weeks and then taper down, ready for mid-May for 26 miles of a hilly course. So I get my break and my holiday right now is running for 4 hours, which sounds, somebody said that sounds horrific, but if you've got two children under two, actually it's a blessing. And it's a relaxing, but I haven't had a break. But it's been Easter. It's gone from really nice at the weekend to absolutely terrible weather here today.
Great. Yeah, no man, it's keep up the training. I think I rang you the other day and you were out running.
Yeah, you're like, are you all right? And I was like, yeah, I'm just running. You're like, oh, shall I leave the phone? I was like, just chat if you
Well,
want.
like I
I'm
was
out for 4 hours.
getting a dirty phone call, but then I realized I'd rang you. So
Well, do you always phone those numbers, Dan? So let's not just put it on the
it's
call. I don't know. Come on, it's a kids show, this one. So, but yeah, Dan's lost for words.
me too. It's all good. I'm really conscious that it looks like I've been crying. But I mean, I do normally cry on a daily basis. It's just my life. But no, yeah, I've got some kind of, I don't know if I've got something going on with my eyes anyway, but they're all bloodshot.
Looks like you've
I
got
need to get.
contacts in, Dan. It makes you look like you've had a facial and you've had your eyebrows done, but maybe you've just got conjunctivitis. Or I even dropped the pink eye, and maybe your child is going in and trumping on your pillow or something. Dan didn't know what that was. Well, if any listeners know what that is and they've seen American Pie, the movie, then please send the messages in to Dan to let him know that it does look like he's got
American
pink eye.
Pie. I think you just brought loads of memories back there. I think I was
We're going to go for about an hour now before our guest even comes in, and they'll have left.
I think I was I just share this when I think I was about 14 years old and American Pie just came out, and it came out, I don't know if you remember this, but it came out at the same time as the Blair Witch Project, and it was literally at the cinema at the same time. And I remember there was about eight of us went to the cinema, like us, me and my mates, and one of our mates, we wanted to go see the Blair Witch Project, obviously, because it was like at the time it was I mean, you would have been an adult by then, Steve. You
I was
probably weren't
40
that
at that time,
concerned.
yeah,
But
40.
it's it was causing so much controversy in the media, and everyone's, yeah, it was crazy. So one of my mates, his mum really didn't want him to go see it. She was like really scared of him going to see it for some reason. I think they were like he was from a Christian background, and she really didn't want it. So we, even though we wanted to go see it, we were like, all right, well, we'll go see something else. So we picked American Pie. So like, yeah, I think probably Blair Witch Project would have been better for a group of 14-year-olds to go see than American Pie. But yeah, wow, it's like the movie of my teenage years. Anyway, I've got sidetracked there, and Steve's not listening anymore. He's on his phone. He's like,
I am,
what
I'm
am I
listening,
going on about?
and I think for that parent that's probably now watched the Blair Witch Project, realised nobody really knew what was going on. Nobody knew whether it was scary or not, and it was basically just a guy running around with a phone in a wood.
I still haven't watched it. Don't have a
Don't, mate, because you don't get to learn anything. It's terrible, terrible. If anybody's a fan, like, wonderful, let us know. But yeah, I
Wasn't it? Was
can't.
it supposed to be real footage? Was that the idea?
I don't even know real footage of what. It's like a rabbit. It's like a camera attached to a rabbit running around the wood that don't really see anything.
You're
Yeah,
really selling it.
I don't. What I want you to do now is watch it and let us know next week what you thought of it and whether you've missed out, Dan, all these years. And
right, should we bring our guest in? So we're going to cover financial education. I think it's something that we kind of talk about all the time, but we don't directly address. I think the last person we had on was Jamie Smith, who you worked with, Steve, probably even before you started working with Jamie. We had Jamie on where we were talking about kind of entrepreneurship and financial sides of education. But that was, I think, that was probably a couple of years ago now. So it's great. It'll be great to revisit this today with Brian. So we'll bring Brian in. Hey, Brian. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Have you seen the Blair Witch Project, Brian?
I have not. I was listening in. I'm like, okay, I got to see this now. Although you guys didn't do a great sell job on it.
Don't watch it. It's 2 hours or whatever. I think it's a long movie. Time you'll never get back.
You've seen American Pie, though, surely.
Yes. I was like, okay, that was formative in childhood. Yeah.
Yeah.
Movie. You made the right choice, everybody. Don't watch the Blair Witch Project. And if anybody you were... still makes money from the Blair Witch Project, I'm sorry. You shouldn't. Terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Don't sue Steve, whatever you do. Yeah. Right, Brian. Brian, I purposely didn't say your surname there because I don't know how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce your surname?
Curcio.
Yeah. I would have mangled that, so I'm glad I didn't
even
try it. So, Brian, it's great to have you on all the way from New York City.
Yeah. So I'm happy to be here and kind of share more about Rapunzel and what we're doing.
That's cool. Yeah. Whereabouts in New York City are you? Are you on Manhattan?
East Village. Yeah, in Manhattan.
Oh, nice. I like East. Yeah.
So yeah, we're going through right now is like it's starting to get warm and you're starting to get all the New York summer trash smells.
Yeah. I know that I went. Is the Comedy Cellar in the East Village?
Yes.
Yeah, I spent a few days around that area. I used to do like comedy, and I was a massive comedy fan. So like went to the Comedy Cellar a few times. Yeah, really nice Chinese restaurant around there. I can't remember what it's called, but it was very good. Yeah, you must be breaking it in. Doesn't like Leonardo DiCaprio live in the East Village?
I'm not quite sure. I know that it's kind of like every day you're walking down the street and it's like, oh, there's a new restaurant. It's kind of like constantly finding new places and your favorite restaurant gets replaced.
It's quite a trendy place to live right here. Yeah, that's cool. So tell us what's Rapunzel and what brought you to it, really?
Yeah, exactly. So Rapunzel is a gamified financial literacy platform. And my partner Miles and I, we came up with the idea my senior year at university, realizing we had a lot of our friends going into finance, going into high paying careers, and really had no idea what to do. Like, what was that next step once you start receiving a paycheck, how you're supposed to invest it. And I guess Miles and I got a little tired of answering the questions of our friends so constantly that it was like, wait a minute, we could build an app for this and kind of help provide that information to more people.
That's cool. So is this something that's kind of active now in schools? Are students using this?
Yeah. So essentially the platform allows students to simulate $10,000 stock and crypto portfolios in real time. And then they're able to enter those portfolios into simulated investing competitions where students are able to compete against each other. And then we're able to fundraise scholarship prizes from a lot of like larger financial institutions. So kind of allowing students to earn while they learn about money.
That's really cool.
Me and Dan were talking about this a while ago. Like you can do this obviously in a different way as an individual through different platforms, and they always say, don't let us to simulate and to kind of bit of a practice before you invest. But I love the whole thing of the students can learn, but actually there's also the reward and the learning process, but also the potential carrot at the end of where does it lead them and the opportunities in terms of scholarship or sponsorship or further learning down the road, which for many might not even be something that they could afford.
Right. Yeah. And I think that everything with money is so emotional and it doesn't change when you get older. So I think that for students to get that most, like the most realistic simulation, having some money on the line that they're able to win or potentially lose, it helps develop a lot of the, I guess, like emotional regulation that you need in terms of investing. And like when things go poorly, it doesn't mean sell everything right away. And some of those issues that I think a lot of retail investors have.
Yeah, I think one of my friends, Jamie Smith, who we had on the podcast, talks about the fact that, and I don't think there is words, basically saying, be as boring as possible with your investments, which kind of conflicts against, in the UK, there's like opportunities for students at different ages when they grow up, when they leave, going to college or whatever, and have the opportunity to bet or to be competitive in a certain way, a particular males of a certain age, generally, maybe I'm generalizing there, and females where they start to be, like say, emotional with it. They start to think, oh, high stakes, I'll go on the roulette or whatever, and I'll put it all on zero or red or black or whatever. And I think investment is potentially seen as that, where actually it can be very, very different. And I bought Dan and Ben all the time around compounding. And all of those fascinating things that I don't really know anything about. I just know I do it.
I think that, yeah, unfortunately, good investing doesn't make good movies. So everything we see of like investors, I mean, if I could teach more kids that the financial industry is not Wolf of Wall Street, it's like they did a great job at making an engaging Leo film. But at the end of the day, it's like he was a criminal. They were selling pen. And so it's like trying to break a lot of the stigmas, I think, of like there's ways to be an informed investor without being a financial expert or without having kind of years of experience around it. So that's what we're kind of trying to teach the kids.
That's cool. So why what's important about this? Because I suppose I grew up in quite a working class background, didn't really know what investment was till I was older, and I suppose a lot of families grow up like that, where actually it's hand to mouth, really. You earn money, you pay your bills, you buy some food, especially at the moment with the cost of living crisis. So why invest it? What's the reason there? Why do you want to spread this education?
Right. Yeah, so I mean, there's a simple goal, and then there's kind of this more complex goal that my founder and I kind of believe in. So the simplest version is trying to unlock this power of dollar cost averaging kind of major indexes as a way to start building generational wealth and kind of providing students with a clear pathway to investing a little bit each month. And what we found is that once you build a good financial habit, they're really hard to break. But once you get into bad financial habits, it's also nearly impossible to get back to good ones. So that's kind of the initial, just trying to get people more active and helping grow their money. But I think that the broader challenge with the way our world works now and not teaching financial education is we're getting a lot less informed citizens in trying to understand what's going on in the world, understanding how policymakers are enacting decisions. They're largely based on these economic motivations. And I think looking back 2 years ago, when I know in the US, at least, we're getting stimulus checks and they're kind of giving money away to businesses and everyone's like, this is great. I think in the UK, you guys, like, you discovered a couple $1 billion in the budget, and it's like, they discovered the printer that prints the money for the billions of dollars. And so now we're kind of seeing those ramifications and the impacts of it with inflation. And I think that if more people had understood how this all works from the beginning, I think you'd have a much more informed conversation about kind of what policies should we be adopting.
Yeah. And I think it's just that whole, I think that's really important, especially education of anything is invaluable. But I think that learning process of how many people really struggled, how many people in business, how many people self-employed, how many people just financially struggled during COVID on a regular basis because they see investment as one of those things where, well, I've got money in the bank, or I want to spend this, I want to go out, I want to kind of live my life. And that whole thing of, well, if I got run over by a bus, you know, money in the bank's not that useful. And I think there's also that nervousness around investment of, well, I don't get really any benefit for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, or even retirement. Why am I even thinking about it now? As a 16-year-old, that was never really shared with me. And I wish it was. I really do, because ultimately you then think, yeah, you can still make an appropriate saving and investment, but still do what you need to do. And actually, what is the people see it as, oh, well, if I put this in, then this is what I'm going to get out. And I just, yeah, I think it's crying out for it. I think it's crying out for it. So what is the, obviously there's a platform, obviously there's a focus in regards to the why, but what learning journey and what support is given in terms of a process as a platform to kind of develop learning and understanding of it rather than just here's your money and or your, right. your fake money and give it a go.
Yeah, and so that's what we figured out. So we did our first competition in April of 2018, and my partner and I would go into the classrooms and teach the kids the basics of the stock market to get started. And what we found was our inboxes started getting flooded from high school students asking follow-up questions. So we started, we built a full financial education curriculum that starts with budgeting and saving, goes through investing into retirement, talking about like real estate and bonds and whatnot. And so that's all integrated into the app so that when you go, you place your first trade, after your first trade successful, we mention what shorting a stock is. And so then once you pass a quiz around shorting, then you're able to bring that into your simulated portfolio. Similar with kind of like learning, you have to learn about crypto before you're able to trade crypto. So it's trying to just insert that curriculum wherever we can to, because like you said, with investing being boring and trying to look out 20, 30 years. And how do you engage a generation that's grown up on 90-second videos are a little too long even. And so what we figured was teaching these long-term investing trends. And then if you want to have fun with your money, you can come to Rapunzel and play in these weekly, monthly investment competitions. But the catch is that while you're trying to make money, we're actually going to teach you about what you're supposed to do with that money.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I think Warren Buffett said that invest like you've only got, you're only going to invest 8 times in your life. So like really, 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 really do your research. And I think it's really interesting that because I suppose investing, there's, you can come, do you come at it from a neutral point of view of, well, this is just the mechanics of how it works. This is what you do. Or do you, do you offer advice? And if you offer advice, how do you kind of balance that?
I mean, so we presented that there's really 4 factors to be looking at before getting into a more technical. So from just a qualitative, you're looking for companies that are profitable. That's usually a pretty good sign of a business. And looking at the amount of market share a company has, if the stock is underpriced, so it's got value, and then the biggest one being the growth. And so with those 4 factors, you can kind of look back on companies that maybe didn't have all of them, like Amazon wasn't profitable for years, but they had such unbelievable growth that investors are like, okay, in 10 years, this is going to be a huge company. And I think Warren Buffett's got that other quote of like, when you buy a company, you should be looking at it, if you're going to hold it for your whole lifetime. So what we try to stress is a lot of our users are high school, university students, and it's like those students understand technology trends better than us, definitely better than the guys in Wall Street. And so it's saying like, you have a lot of power just in your insights. And so this idea of sticking with investing in companies that you know, and that you spend your money at, it's kind of just allowing you to shift your mindset from being a consumer to thinking more like an investor, I think.
Yeah. And I think alongside that, especially if you go down the route, if you're not going to be a day trader, if you're going to be like a lifetime investor in companies, then it's the kind of stock market education side of things is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is just, it's general just business education, isn't it? Like how do you read an annual report and understand what's going on with a company, and how do you look for trends? How can you read about the company and get an idea of is it still going to be around in a few years? Is it going to have grown? Is it, can you get a feel for the CEO? Is it, are they a good CEO? Are they actually bringing value to the company? All that type of thing, I suppose, is the contextual education that goes around this.
Right. Yeah. And I think that when you're reading through the news even, and you hear about CEO of whatever company decided to do this and they're opening a new office, it's like, you can look at it without understanding the finances behind it. It's like, why are they relocating their offices to a new city? It's like, oh, there's tax breaks. And so understanding all of those things, you quickly see how you don't have to be in finance for these things to affect you. And I think looking at things beyond investing, most people have a memory of their first paycheck and looking down at it and seeing how much is taken out for taxes and going, wait, what just happened? And so it's like, we teach reading, writing, arithmetic in school, and we say it's applicable to all careers, but somehow financial education drops off when really it's probably the most universal thing that we all could benefit from, I think.
Yeah, and just on that point, I think it's invaluable to, like I say, have an understanding of business, but also that values and beliefs led investment and understanding that there are certain opportunities out there where if you're just in it for the money and the return, which many are, and I suppose rightly so, you know, if you're investing your money, you're taking the risk. But there are obviously then the unpickings and the underlying issues of what what's behind that money and that the potential opportunities. I know there's a lot of, I have a beta testing bank called Tread. Don't know if anybody's used it, but Tread is one of these banks that, like I say, is in beta, but they as a bank only invest in green and renewables and those kind of things, where the problem is in terms of the banking system per se, from what I hear and what I've read and what I've researched, is they will take the money and reinvest it in fossil fuels and lots of different things behind it, which not everybody has the opportunity to then say, right, well, I'm going to completely change banks. And it is a risk at times, but also that understanding of what do you stand for as an individual, teaching that process and thinking, right, well, if you don't believe in fossil fuels, or actually you don't believe in the views of some countries, then actually making this investment here actually conflicts against what your beliefs and values are, that's fine, but you need to have an understanding of it and the moral compass of investments, and even just decision making away from talking about financial investment is one that needs to be taught, because so much false information out there, and I think that it transcends and it translates across different sectors rather than just the financial stuff that Rapunzel's doing, I guess. Brian.
Yeah, and when we bring, so a lot of the times, one of the modules we actually have that we teach students is this idea of the power of a consumer. And it's not totally about consuming. It's what you described. It's like looking at your finance. There are a lot of financial institutions now that have kind of come out saying, we're not going to provide debt services to big oil companies unless they explain how they're going towards sustainability. And so things like that, students really gravitate to it, because I think that younger generations are feeling more and more empowered to kind of speak up against large corporations or speak out about where they would like to see the direction going. And I think once students are able to see, look, you can decide to support a company with how you purchase, but you can also support based on how you invest. It's really powerful to see this huge stock market and then be like, no, but you're one of the players in it. You're able to influence it.
Agree. And I suppose from start to or idea to actually get it going, what did that look like as somebody starting a business? We hadn't even really, what from an idea of, oh, me and a friend thought we were going to do this, and people kept asking us financial advice, so we thought we'll do something else. What does a whole process look like for anybody that's wanting to start out, if you unpick that?
So we had an untraditional, so neither my partner or I knew anything to do with coding when we started the app, which is actually, it's not even the first sentence in how to build an app. It's like, they assume that you understand that going into it. So that was our first challenge. I studied math at university, so I had done some work with understanding how things work. So initially we were working with a couple outsourced developers and just kind of managing them. But in that managing process of figuring out how you build, and it's really hard to articulate, like, here, I have this idea for an app. Can you build it? It never turns out how you imagine it. And so it quickly turned into, well, wait, here, I'll change this little piece of code or I'll change that. And so I think about 6 months after coming up with the project and getting going on it, I actually took over all of the coding responsibilities and then embarked on about 2 years of trying to explain why things didn't work and trying to just kind of grow and build some traction. And then, so I think where my partner and I were really kind of, it benefited us was our ability to be able to partner with larger organizations to kind of lend ourselves credibility early on. And I think most early startups would benefit from that. So that competition in 2018, when we did our first one, we approached the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and asked them to endorse the competition. And they said, we're not going to give you any prize money, but if you find prize money, we'll lend our name. And so then we went down the street to Ariel Investments, which is the largest minority-owned asset manager in the US. And we asked them to contribute the scholarships. And they said, well, if the Federal Reserve is on board, we're like, so then we had this chicken and egg. So we actually, it's been long enough now, we went to the Federal Reserve and said, great news, we've got the $10,000 for prizes. And they go, okay, you can put our name on. And the same day we went back to a meeting with Ariel and said, Federal Reserve's in, can we have the 10,000? So I think that was a huge catalyst for us to, when we were walking into schools or meeting with teachers saying, we're with the Federal Reserve, they're like, okay, we'll take a meeting now. When we were going in saying, we're a startup, Rapunzel, we're both born, like we're both from Chicago. Teachers are like, okay, you can come back next year. So that was kind of a really bad. And so from there, really, we had a really great competition in Chicago, worked with about 2,500 students. And the following year got interest from other schools outside of Chicago. And so we grew it to doing a national program. And the development of all that curriculum in the app was actually a function of Miles and I not being able to go into the classroom and speak to students. So I think we have this issue when looking at financial education that we somehow expect teachers to feel comfortable teaching something that they've never learned in school. And so a lot of times it's like, this is great, can you come teach the kids? And so we had to try and figure out a scalable way that there was at one point we bought a van and we drove Chicago to Houston to Miami, basically across the whole United States, visiting schools and speaking to kids. And it's just one too many days staying at a 1 or 2 star hotel on the highway that it was like, okay, we should be able to automate this.
It's so interesting that, because I think as a former teacher myself, I think one of the biggest barriers is the actual education of the teachers themselves to be able to talk about, because I suppose just the way the system's set up, if you're a teacher, the chances are the only investing you're probably doing is your pension, because you are in a system where you're getting paid by the hour or paid as a salary. You're in that side of society, so you, and I'm being very general when I say this, but the chances are you're probably not going to have lots of in-depth knowledge about investing, because if you did, you probably broke away from the 9-to-5 job and all that type of thing. So it's almost like a self-perpetuating cycle of the, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but of the ignorant leading the blind leading the blind, really, I guess.
Yeah, the way we've likened it is it's like that childhood game telephone, except it's turned into this generational situation where if your parents don't understand financial literacy, you don't learn about it as a kid, and then you subsequently pass it on. So it's not only that financial literacy is benefiting people with money to help preserve that wealth and grow it, but conversely, it's hurting people who don't have it, that you're never learning the tricks to start accumulating or to benefit from the compound growth. And actually, one of the best ways we've found to engage teachers around the program is hosting free workshops that explain the pension program. Because it's kind of a lot of teachers assume it'll be there and assume there's someone in charge who knows what they're doing, but they actually have no idea how their retirement is even structured.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's crazy, isn't it? Like, we trust our money to, and most people trust their money to a company to invest it so that they've got a pension, and but don't actually know anything about it. I suppose that I'd love to get into the crypto side of it, because you've obviously opted to include crypto investments within your platform. There's a lot of, I suppose, with like any new technology, there's a lot of regulation arguments, and I suppose, how do you view that? Are you kind of viewing that crypto will always be here now? Is it, and so educating children is going to be the best thing to do around this? And I suppose, how do you see that playing out in terms of, are we going to have regulated, normalized crypto? Is it going to be state-backed crypto that wins out in the end? And I suppose, why is that important for education?
So I think that initially, I mean, we saw this first wave of crypto over the past couple of years. And I think one of the symptoms of not having strong financial education is that you have this new technology, or just any new technology, there's going to be fraud that enters into the system. And I think, like, there was fraud on telephones, that when the internet first came out, there was kind of phishing and spam and whatnot. So I think that people took advantage of that and selling these quick rich schemes. And what we've tried to explain is, like, it was on crypto, like on the blockchain network, but it's not really crypto, and it's not the offering that some of the other major cryptocurrencies have. So I think that we could have avoided a lot of these big crashes where you have a company that's kind of, staking was a big thing that it was kind of like, okay, you're not really making 30% a year if you can't withdraw the money. So trying to teach kids more about liquidity. But I think, so from that standpoint, I think until we're really teaching people that they're not going to be scammed, there does need to be regulation. I think the way they've gone about regulation, where it's kind of, if there's a bad news cycle for crypto, okay, now we're going to revisit regulation to make the newspapers happy, isn't the way to do it. It's kind of like that, who will guard the guards? Because I don't know, I don't feel really confident that the regulators really understand crypto. And I also think we got a little ahead of ourselves in saying that, like, universal adoption, because I think there's a lot of countries that have a strong central bank, kind of believe in their currency as a whole, and it hasn't experienced outsized inflation. Whereas there's other countries where you can't take the banking industry for certain in any regard. And so I think there's huge power in that side of it, but unfortunately it's been hijacked by kind of leverage and speculation and trying to figure out how do you make money off of this, that, like, with inflation at what, 8, 10, 15%, it's like Bitcoin should be going to the moon. I mean, so the fact that it isn't, and it's really susceptible to interest rates, kind of shows that there's so much leverage in that system. So I don't think it's going away anytime soon. I think there's definitely a use case. I think removing kind of intermediaries between banks and financial transactions would be huge. But seeing it replace the pound or replace the dollar, I think, is a little further off than Twitter would like you to believe.
Yeah.
Will they ever let it, whether it's capable or whether it's allowed, I suppose. I won't go too much into it, but yeah, based on bad news stories, it is reviewed and analyzed, isn't it, in terms of many different things, new technologies, the AI stuff, and all these kind of things. If, oh, look, this is the art of the possible and the art of the nightmare, of course it is, but also Silicon Bank and lots of different things are having bad days and bad times, and ultimately we're not as quick to review those, because actually the status quo is maintained by those things have been around for a long, long time, and we won't be quick to change regulation of that, because many, many people and centrally will suffer, not right. Decentralization. And it's that conflict, isn't it, in terms of control and giving people control, which is a rabbit hole maybe we don't go down. But
I do think that It's interesting that people forget some of the benefits of having a centralized bank when you start looking at cryptocurrency. And it's like, okay, there's deflation. And so you have these rising price pressures, and that part's great. But take 2 years ago, and yes, we're dealing with the impacts of it now and the effects of printing money and kind of making sure people had stimulus during that initial COVID lockdowns. But just think of if we weren't able to print money, which I understand is what crypto, it's like, look, you don't want the central bank, but there's countries that are doing a lot worse off because they aren't in a situation where they're able to print money. And so having a stronger currency and being able to hand out these checks, it hurts your like exchange rates, and there's negative impacts to it. But having a government that's able to give you a handout when things get tough is actually really beneficial for citizens. And they wouldn't be doing that if we all adopted Bitcoin. And I think the energy considerations is the other side, that if you're looking at, it's like, okay, we created a new and better currency. It's like, okay, that's great. But we created this new and better currency that uses more electricity than a lot of civilized countries. It's like, I think we need to start looking at how beneficial is it and kind of weighing those costs.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I suppose I suppose it's like a lot of other areas at the moment in terms of artificial intelligence and how and other areas of blockchain technology and how we're in a very interesting time in the world and how much and people are predicting that the world's going to change drastically. Some people are on the other side of the fence and go, well, actually, it's just the next technology we'll use. And so trying to educate students and learners around financial education on a system that is kind of dangling by a thread, really, or seems to be anyway, is a difficult job to do, really. I suppose in terms of the education that you provide, do you provide that wider context? Do you mention inflation? Do you mention economic crises and how the projection might be? Because I suppose you students might be using this this kind of what do you call it, like it's not a real stock market they're trading on, but I suppose the idea is you want when they're old enough to be able to do it and to be able to invest. So are you kind of informing them about that world in the next 5 years and what that might look like?
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, my partner and I actually, we met in 2008. So we have a really great backdrop to be like, look, if we would have bought just the broader market the day before the financial crisis, it'd be worth about three times as much now. And so trying to show that everything, because money is so emotional, you see headlines. And I mean, 2008, it was like the world's going to end. The entire banking system's going to collapse. And it was like, okay, look out a year from then, things didn't change as drastically as people thought. I mean, it was really bad, but it wasn't kind of the world ending. And I think that people saw that again with kind of when there was a huge dip during COVID. And now we're kind of in this other period of looking at, right, like blockchain and the AI discussions have gotten, it's scary how fast that's all moving. But trying to understand that it's like the world isn't going to end tomorrow. It might end in 5-10 years and we can need to be worried about the dangers. But I think understanding that kind of market prices overreact. And so we do try to stress that to students and show different historical crashes and trying to understand why did Apple lose half its value when there was a financial crisis. It's like, it doesn't make sense, but it's this contagion and the fears behind it.
Interesting. You did say that the world's not going to end maybe 5-10 years.
Yeah, well, you can't always see if it ends.
Do you know something we don't?
Yeah.
I know what you meant. I don't know if you've thought about this much, and this could be a bit of a curveball, really, but there's a lot of talk at the minute around AI kind of coming together with trading and coming together with. And I think I read something on Twitter yesterday, a company that's called themselves, what have they called themselves? Or something like Crypto GPT raised 10 million from venture capitalists. And there's a lot of people saying, actually, when you look at the background, that it comes across as very scammy in terms of what they're doing. So, but I suppose my point is, there's a lot of people looking at how can AI and especially the crypto side of finance come together. And I suppose there's a lot of people as well using ChatGPT to try and get financial advice by feeding it historic prices and getting it to predict and all that type of thing on stock prices. Do you see AI, and I suppose the automation, I guess, is probably the right term, the automation of trade and going to be something that's big and helpful within this arena?
Yes. So, I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, the automation's great for maintaining those habits. And it's like, look, if I like Apple stock and I want to put $50 in a month, having that automation to not have to look at it is great. The challenge is, so already a majority of stocks that trade via computer systems and algorithms. Challenge is that it's a small number of players doing a massive number of trades. And what we found is that you can't go into it. It's the same as why you can't think, I'm going to be the best stock picker, because you're competing against this whole market of people that fancy themselves as stock pickers. And I think what we'll start to see with the AI is, if you start trading with an AI and Steve starts trading with an AI, now your AIs are trading against each other. And I don't know what's going to happen. I think you start to see really dramatic swings when you have a bad news story, because all of the different AIs will read like Costco misses earnings and everyone goes out to sell it. And sometimes you might have people that didn't notice, or you didn't like, weren't as much fazed by that news story. But I think you might start to see the AI models, unless we start really explicitly telling it, like, look at a long-term investment horizon. I think that's where you're going to start seeing this compression that, I mean, we all might be high frequency traders and none of us will be able to explain how it works, which I don't know. I think at some point you start kind of getting rid of that free money, because everyone is now trading with these AI tools, that I don't know how effective it'll be.
That's because essentially, I mean, probably one of the biggest impacts is the speed, isn't it? Like if I'm a day trader and I'm at home watching it go up and down and then reading the news at the same time, I can look at that, make a decision within maybe a few minutes, pull some money out, put some money in. But an AI could do that in a fraction of a second, I guess, if you right. trained it. And I suppose it's just going to speed that process up. Might not necessarily change it, but it's going to push the human out of it, isn't it?
If the human can't. We'll see the larger scale swings, because if we're all using the same algorithm or whatnot, I suppose it's the development of it and the training of oneself to use AI and add the human intelligence in terms of how you chat with it, like, you know, how you have a conversation and what you put into it. Dan, you say this all the time. Basically, the strength of the AI for a lot of the new ones to the market is the conversation you have, the input is the output. If everybody puts basic information in, then actually you'll see everybody moving exactly the same way. But maybe if the world doesn't end in 5 years, maybe actually.
And I suppose it would have to be. Because for liable reasons, I don't know how a company's going to be able to come up with an AI that you can trust, because you'd have to hand over all rights in terms of being able to take any action if it does lose you money. It's probably still going to need that human confirmation in there, unless you build the system yourself, I guess.
Right.
It's like trusting your pension with somebody, I suppose, isn't it?
A financial advisor or an AI.
It's interesting. Like, that's my world at the minute, looking at kind of how AI is going to impact different industries. And I often compare it to kind of, let's look at 1997. Nobody could have guessed that within 10 years, the iPhone would have been presented by Steve Jobs, and I suppose it's just thinking, what are the implications of this? How how will things turn out? And we all know, don't we, that regulation isn't going to be fast enough. It never is. And it's not. I know we like to have conversations where we're like, yeah, we're going to have to learn our lessons from social media and how we were slow with regulation. We're still going to be slow on this. Governments are just notoriously slow. And it's interesting. I heard I saw a funny tweet before of someone saying that the reason why Google are really dragging their feet with their Google Bard is because they want to avoid having to explain to an 80-year-old in the Senate how AI works. But I think it's a bit of a dig at Google, but I think there's a point there in terms of who is regulating and the knowledge base of the people who are regulating. But I think where it could go, especially with financial systems, it's quite scary, really, because I suppose it might come down to that whole factor of who's in control and who controls this, and if we do hand over control, what does that look like?
Right. Yeah, and I think I don't think it's necessarily the best idea for people to. It's like, oh, we don't have to learn about our money. We have AI bots for that now. It's like that's probably one of the few things that we should still be understanding ourselves.
Yeah. And that kind of goes at the heart of your business model, really, doesn't it? That we need to understand this stuff. But it does, like I was listening to a podcast with Reid Hoffman a few weeks ago. He's obviously one of the founders of OpenAI. And he thinks it'll get to a point, and I think, I don't know if he was talking about kind of when we get artificial general intelligence, but he thinks it'll get to a point where we will just trust it. We will just go, right, it's the processing of it is just far beyond any individual's understanding. And he makes the point that actually, if you look in our world, we do trust certain systems. So we trust our biological system, for example. We don't. It's unpredictable. We could drop down dead tomorrow. We could live till we're in our 90s. We just trust the biological system that we inhabit, if that's the right term. But, and he also says, actually, to a certain extent, we trust the economic and financial system that we live in. Not even the most advanced economics professors still don't fully understand a lot of the economic context and situation that we're in, because you get different theories, you get people debating, what does this mean, where's this going to go? So is AI just going to be something that we're going to have to trust? But I suppose, just coming back to what I said there about your business model, is actually, we shouldn't just trust how finance works. We should be an active participant in that, I guess.
Right. And I think that was the case before AI hit the stage this year. It was kind of, I think that when you go downtown, it's like the biggest buildings in most cities have the names of banks on them. And so they own this, like, or at least mortgage this crazy real estate. And so it's understanding, like, how do the banks have so much money? Why are they making so much? And it's like trying to understand. And I think earlier when we were talking about teaching kids about inflation, and that we tell kids, put your money in a bank in a savings account. And it's like, if you leave your money in a savings account, it's worth less every year. So trying to understand that there's better ways to put your money to work.
Yeah. I literally was just with my daughter, who's 3-year-old, this morning, and she got a £10 note in an Easter card, from her grandma, who's obviously not very imaginative with gifts. So I said, she was about to go to the supermarket with her mum, and I said to her, you can either take it with you, you can spend it, you can put it in your bank account where it'll probably depreciate, or you can invest it in Bitcoin. What do you want to do? Obviously she chose spend it at the supermarket, but yeah, it's I suppose it is difficult. And I suppose getting back to my very original point at the start of this show, that the majority of people at the moment, and I don't have the stats on it, so I'm guessing the majority of people are living in a situation where it is hand to mouth. It is everything goes on the bill or the food shopping because of the financial situation. And I guess it probably leads, and I'm not a most of the time I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there's a lot of people out there who would say the system's almost set up to keep the majority of the population ignorant about this stuff, and the people who know about this stuff, keep them wealthy, keep them in control of that system. Now, I'm not suggesting in in any way that there's a uniform effort out there to do that. But I suppose it's that self-perpetuating system that we talked about before, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard to know. I think if anything, it's just been the reason that we're not teaching it. I mean, I think conspiracy theory would have be too logistical for how inept I think some of these bodies are at implementing change, that it'd be much easier for them to be trying for 20 years. And it's more realistic than some grand conspiracy, I think. But it's hard to say that, like, when the schools aren't teaching, but then the schools have these big budget deficits that I know in Chicago now, our public school system in the city has gotten like a $9 billion deficit that they can't figure out where the money went. And it's like, okay, maybe if people understood money and were able to read a budget better, we might be able to hold some of our public institutions a little more accountable.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, it's been amazing to talk to you, and we let you get on with your day over in New York, and it's a late morning there. So thanks for sharing your app, Rapunzel. So I've just got rapunzelinvestments.com.
Yep.
Is the website. I'm just having a look there. And I suppose, can adults use this, or is it just for
Yeah, learners? So for students under 18, there's scholarship competitions. And then if you're over 18, we actually have free cash competitions every week, which the top 30% win a portion of the prize pool. So it's kind of keeping people engaged. And yeah, so it's really all ages can benefit from it.
That's cool. That's amazing. You got a cool merch store on there as well.
Thank
you. Yeah. I'm guessing they have like a fantasy league in for American football. And obviously I know you've been in London, so do like a Super Six or a fantasy football team.
It's really, that's the similarity. So
I can compete against Dan and Ben, and we can put our own stake in and decide who's a winner. That'd be a wonderful competition.
Exactly.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
No, I really appreciate you guys having me, and I got to check out Blair Witch Project tonight, I guess.
Yeah. No, or American, I think no. I'll stick with American Pie.
American Pie, get it on 1-55 or whatever there is. A retirement reunion or something coming up in a few years, knowing the way the film industry is. But no, Brian, it's been great to have you on.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Have a good day. I'm delaying because I was in full screen and I don't have access to the outro music, but I've got it now. cheers, Brian. Take care.
Cheers. Thank you. 1, 2, 3.